From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we're talking about stuff we think we know about, but in fact, we don't know. From our archives, we've pulled stories of debunkings of stories great and small that have served as cultural signposts, sending us in the wrong direction. Some of these stories seem impervious to change because we like them as they are. They make sense to us. They fit in with what we think we know. Brendan Nyhan is a blogger and assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College. He's part of a team that for the last few years has been studying how people so easily ignore corrections to the record. The latest study tested a new way to blow past our inborn barriers, but it seems to have fizzled too. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Now, this study is building off previous research that you've done on correcting misperceptions. Research, in fact, that we've covered on the show. But can you give us just a quick rundown of what those earlier experiments showed?
Sure. My co-author, Jason Reifler, and I looked at, can the media effectively correct misperceptions? Which seems like a simple question, but no one had really tested that scientifically.
And you found actually that when people had their misperceptions challenged, certain people at least were more likely to become more firmly entrenched in that belief.
That's right. People were so successful at bringing to mind reasons that the correction was wrong, they actually ended up being more convinced in the misperception than the people who didn't receive the correction. So the correction, in other words, was making things worse.
So tell me about your latest study.
What we wanted to understand was whether it was possible to correct the misperception out there that Barack Obama is a Muslim, which has been shown to be held by 10 to 12% of the public, and another 25 to 35% isn't sure if he is a Muslim or not. So what we wanted to do was to see, is it possible to correct that misperception?
And something that we already knew is that you can't say Barack Obama is not a Muslim, that by simply offering the denial, you get nowhere because people tend to forget the not, and the original statement in all its glorious wrongness is merely reinforced.
That's right. The not seems to fade away. The canonical example in politics is Richard Nixon saying, I'm not a crook. And after a while, people start associating Nixon and crook. So we thought the same principle would apply to Obama saying, I'm not a Muslim. What we wanted to do was to test the approach of saying, I'm not a Muslim, against an alternative, which is to say, I'm a Christian.
Sounds like a perfect plan.
It only worked some of the time. When non-white students were interviewing respondents to the study, the message seemed to work. And in particular, with Republicans, the group that was most likely to hold the misperception. But what happened when it was only white students administering the experiment was precisely the opposite. The correction appeared to actually make things worse.
And did you assume that when they said that they believed him when talking to your students who were not white, then your subjects were lying?
We don't know if they were lying, but we do have evidence from a tool that tries to measure people's associations. In other words, their unconscious perceptions of Obama, that when the non-white students were present, people were giving responses that didn't line up with their unconscious associations.
That's a nice way of saying you're suspecting that they were lying.
I'm hesitant to use the L word, but it seems that it may have created an environment that people weren't comfortable saying what they really thought.
And yet, we'll be talking later in the show about the tendency of people to lie about their own racism to pollsters. The Bradley effect is actually a myth.
That's right. That's a very interesting study. It may be the fact that our experiment was conducted in person, whereas most of the polls that go into these studies of the so-called Bradley effect are conducted over the phone.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've spent years doing studies on correcting misperceptions, and you also ran Spinsanity, which is a political fact-checking website that was a precursor to sites like FactCheck and PolitiFact. What do you think is the best way to combat misperceptions?
When we were working on Spinsanity, we had a group of readers who were very interested in finding out about political spin. And even then, it was incredibly difficult to get them to accept corrections that targeted the side that they liked the best. So you can imagine how hard it would be with the general public. So what I think is the most effective approach is to go after elites, to shame the people who are promoting these things, who are putting them out there.
You're talking about the punditocracy and politicians, and you're talking about going to the wellspring of these misperceptions?
That's right. One of the things we tried to do at Spinsanity was just to show in excruciating detail how frequently people like Ann Coulter and Michael Moore distorted the facts. And at some point, people have to be cast out of polite society. You have to simply say, that is irresponsible, and we're not going to give you our airtime, our print, to make that sort of a claim. Politicians and talk radio hosts, they're going to push these things when it's in their interest to do so. It's a simple cost-benefit calculation. What I want to do is increase the cost.
So, Brendan, how is this supposed to work? I mean, you're talking about people like Ann Coulter. Surely you're not going to be shaming these people.
They're hard to shame, but we give them access to the megaphone, and the media has to exercise some responsibility in who gets airtime.
Can you give me one example where this worked?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I thought so.
Weapons of mass destruction is better than it was in the aftermath of the war. People who believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, it's still out there, but it's a lot smaller than it was.
The reason why I'm asking this question is because this week we're looking back at some enduring myths that have been perpetuated by the media that have been very hard to dislodge. How hard should we be working to correct the historical record, or is it just a Sisyphean enterprise?
There are things that at some point you have to just say it's water under the bridge and we can't undo the damage that we've done. But there are others that keep coming back up. The Obama Muslim misperception is underpinning all sorts of claims and insinuations that are still being made. So there is a continuing relevance to the misperception, and that's why it's so important to keep fighting it.
Brendan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Brendan Nyhan is a blogger and political scientist at Duke University.
But who's to say which misperceptions are still relevant and which aren't? At the concert on the Mall the day before Obama's inauguration, the name of Rosa Parks was invoked by Samuel L. Jackson for her courage, the courage of a weary woman who had had enough.
This is what Rosa Parks said. I did not get on the bus to get arrested. I got on the bus to go home. I had no idea that history was being made. I was just tired of giving in. Somehow I felt I was right to stand up to that bus driver. I knew I could have been lynched or beaten when the police came. I chose not to move. I knew that I had the strength of my ancestors with me.
But the real Rosa Parks was more than just the simple seamstress of legend. To correct the record, we'll play a brief excerpt of an interview we did on the occasion of Parks' death with Tim Tyson, a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School. He told us that Parks was active in the civil rights movement and that the movement was looking, waiting for someone like Rosa to make a stand.
They were, in fact, looking for such a thing. Within a year, there had been a couple of cases of black women arrested on the buses who they almost had a boycott around, but who weren't just right in one way or another. And so they were sort of waiting for this case. They did not say, however, you know, Mrs. Parks, would you mind going and getting arrested on the bus today? We're ready to do the bus boycott. When she got arrested, the word went forth and people in the community knew what would happen.
And yet, the Washington Post, in its appreciation of Rosa Parks, referred very much to her as a seamstress and very little to her as an activist. It did nothing to squelch the myth that she was just one woman who on a certain day had had enough. Why do you suppose that that myth endures?
I think for some reason we are unwilling to honor people who are politically active. We want to honor people who just have had enough and sort of spontaneously won't take it anymore. But somehow if they get categorized as active citizens, which would be a positive way of saying it, as troublemakers, which is the way we often think about such persons, then somehow it becomes self-serving, part of a movement which we're less comfortable with. And I think that's just an American popular cultural narrative that we pick up very quickly. And indeed, that started very quickly after the bus boycott. They talked about her tired feet. That gets mentioned a lot more often than it should. She may have been a little bit tired, but that had nothing to do with the decision that she made.
In that same Washington Post obituary, there was, it seemed, a palpable sense of disappointment that the myth is, in fact, a myth. Why are we so reluctant to let it go?
There's a sense in which Mrs. Parks is very important to our post-civil rights racial narrative, because we really want a kind of sugar-coated civil rights movement that's about purity and interracial nonviolence. And so we don't really want to meet the real Rosa Parks. We don't, for example, want to know that in the late 1960s, Rosa Parks became a black nationalist and a great admirer of Malcolm X. I met Rosa Parks at the funeral of Robert F. Williams, who had fought the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina with a machine gun in the late 1950s and then fled to Cuba and had been a kind of international revolutionary icon of black power. Ms. Parks delivered the eulogy at his funeral. She talks in her autobiography and says that she never believed in nonviolence and that she was incapable of that herself and that she kept guns in her home to protect her family. But we want a little old lady with tired feet. You may have noticed we don't have a lot of pacifist white heroes. We prefer our black people meek and mild, I think.
Lest we suggest that it was not an act of heroism, let's just recall that she was hounded out of Montgomery and had to flee under death threat 4 points north. Over the years, Rosa Parks has occasionally expressed irritation that the myth endures, but she also, in other ways, cultivated her iconic image. Was she ambivalent about her place in history?
I think she was a seasoned political activist who knew that it was useful for her to seem apolitical. But the myth was only useful, really, in 1955 and 1956. But as the years go by, of course, historians didn't do much better. We expect historians to dig a little deeper than just the politics of image.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks much.
Tim Tyson is a senior researcher at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School.
Coming up, myths, lies, urban legends, and uncorrected first drafts of history.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, with more cultural correctives from our archives. We recorded this piece in what was the latter part of the last election cycle. As Barack Obama continued on his march toward victory, pundits grew increasingly skeptical. Could he pull it off, they asked, or would he be thwarted by the so-called Bradley effect?
The term refers to the 1982 California gubernatorial race between Republican Attorney General George Duke Majan, who's white, and Democrat and five-term Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, who's black. Even though the polls projected a Bradley win, he lost, supposedly due to hidden racism. In October 2008, political watchers obsessed over the Bradley effect, or whether there could be a reverse Bradley effect, where whites lied about supporting Obama, or even a Bradley effect, whereby voters might be influenced by all the blather over the Bradley effect. Blair Levin worked for Bradley in the 1982 campaign, and he says we're reading the wrong draft of history.
I'm not a pollster, I'm not a statistician, but I was a witness to history, and to hear the history kind of inaccurately reflected caused me sometimes to laugh and sometimes to get a little upset.
I was the chief pollster in that election and part of the strategy team.
Lance Torrance was working for Bradley's opponent, Duke Majan, but like Blair, he's had enough of all the references to the effect.
In fact, I took it personally because so many people were quoting what happened in 82 that probably weren't even alive then, number one, and number two, had their facts messed up. And what really determined that it was a close election was the tracking. That was where we did interviews every single night. And from that, we knew we were doing better and better. We started out double-digit behind in early October, and by mid-October, it climbed within 7 points or so. By the end of the election, we knew it was within 1% either way. The Republicans did an absentee vote program stronger than the Democrats. The Democrats probably took that election a little bit for granted.
That day, we all had the emotion we thought we were going to win, but we also knew there was a significant risk we wouldn't. It was going to be a close election.
Bradley campaign staffer Blair Levin.
The night of the election, when the exit polls had declared Bradley the victor, there were 3,000 people celebrating downstairs at the hotel where we were having the party. And I was upstairs looking at the early polling results and realizing that first there were a huge number of absentee ballots that were not in our calculations and that they must have come from the Republican side. And then second, that there were the turnout in Central Valley was significantly greater than we had anticipated. And that had to do with the fact that there was this gun control initiative, which we knew would be a problem, but we had not anticipated the extent to which people in the Central Valley would show up, and they were largely Republican voters as well.
That blew a hole in the Democrats' arithmetic.
And they lost by a small margin, but they still lost.
I think it was less than 100,000 votes.
But Levin says hidden racism did not cause Bradley's defeat.
Well, to be clear, race definitely played a role in the election in a way that I suspect we'll never know. But what I feel very confident of is that those who say that there's this Bradley effect in which people lie to pollsters, that was not the cause. Bradley actually won Election Day. That is to say, if you take out the absentee ballots, he would have won.
Lance Torrance.
Now, the suggestion that race was a factor, and this is very important, really came from the preeminent public pollster in the state, Mervyn Field, who ran the California poll. And he proclaimed rather loudly right before the election that Bradley would win handily, in fact, by 7 or 8 points. The press accepted this as probably going to make history. It was Murfield, after the election was over, after the embarrassing results, who said, race must have been a factor. That's the only reason I can think of why our data was so off. But he never once really proved his case. And so from his comments after the election, the Bradley effect was born.
And Torrance, still a Republican strategist, says it persists because it's politically marketable.
This is purely a suggestion on my part of how it would be used in a marketing sense. You would tell particularly the black community that there is a lot of hidden racism that's going to somehow turn the election around and that you need to make sure you vote. Why else would a theory as porous, that is, not solid, be carried forward so long in American politics unless people wanted to keep race front and center? And it's quite historical to have a black man running for president of the United States, and a lot of people want that to happen. And indeed, Obama's favored to win this election. So it becomes one of these shadowy mysteries that maybe he might be denied this election at the last moment by invoking this Bradley effect. And I think that does a disservice to the American voting public.
The thing that struck me personally most.
Blair Levin.
Tom Bradley was really a wonderful person and really practiced the politics of inclusion. He presided for 20 years over an incredibly multicultural city. He helped bring the city together in many, many ways. And the notion that Tom Bradley is now remembered to a generation as part of this incident in which race played a very significant role, or at least that's the urban legend, saddened me tremendously. I mean, Tom Bradley ought to be remembered for something else, how he governed.
The Bradley effect had more or less dropped out of the political lexicon when it returned with a vengeance after the New Hampshire primary, famously lost by Obama after he was leading in the polls. In fact, in a Nexus search, we found only 87 mentions of the Bradley effect in the 5 years prior to that primary. In the 9 months that followed, it was mentioned more than 1,000 times. But polling wunderkind Nate Silver, who blogs at 538.com, told us there was no Bradley effect in New Hampshire. He says Obama's numbers went up after a decisive victory in the Iowa caucus, but a lot happened in the days leading to New Hampshire that the polls didn't have time to reflect.
In that interval between, I think it was a Thursday when Obama won the Iowa caucus and the Tuesday when New Hampshire voted, you had a debate. Hillary had a very dramatic kind of teary moment at a press conference. And you also had a Republican race. And in New Hampshire, they have an open primary. Literally, you kind of go in and decide, do I want a red ballot or a blue ballot, you know, Democrat or Republican? About half of the voters are independents. So I think a lot of independents who like both Obama and McCain might have looked at those polls and said, Obama's 8 points, 9 points ahead. McCain's in a very tight race with Mitt Romney, I'm going to have more leverage if I vote for McCain because I want to see those two candidates nominated.
So you refer to a study by a professor at Harvard as the definitive study on the Bradley effect. What did it find?
Yeah, it was a professor, I think, named Daniel Hopkins, who's a postdoc at Harvard. And he went back and looked at the polling in, you know, all sorts of races, gubernatorial races, Senate races, as well as this year's primaries, going back to 1980. When he found there did used to be a Bradley effect, which was pretty noticeable, maybe a 5 or 6 point margin where a black candidate would underperform his polls. In Chicago, Harold Washington won his mayoral race, but was supposed to win by a larger margin. You know, David Dinkins in New York, you know, Wilder in Virginia, it's sometimes called the Wilder effect as well. So there were enough cases in that window from about 1982 to 1991. But sometime in the 90s, you stop seeing this where the polls are accurate. You know, for example, for Harold Ford in the Senate race in Tennessee, he lost, but he didn't lose by any more than was expected. So why it disappeared is the interesting question to me. The Harvard study speculates maybe it was the fact that issues like crime and welfare and affirmative action, which were, you know, really hot-button issues during the 80s, are not really the kind of at the forefront of the discussion today. I also think the fact that the electorate has changed, where racism is inversely correlated with education levels. Right now, I think something like 75 to 80% of the electorate has been to at least some college where you'll integrate with students of different backgrounds, whereas in 1988, 84, that number was more like 60%. It's generational as well. I mean, but it's partly just these things turning over slowly at a time, but there's no evidence that the Bradley effects existed for the past 10 years or so. We're kind of relying on quarter-century-old examples to kind of prop this idea up.
So it's a combination of essentially two things. Our society has changed, and polling methods have also changed, right?
I think so. I mean, you know, I also think people's attitude toward polls may have changed. If a pollster calls, you see them as a stranger, whereas before, you might see them almost as a neighbor or a friend, and then you might gravitate toward socially desirable behavior. That's where the whole notion comes from, the idea that people want to conceal their racism, I suppose. But if you see the pollster as just an anonymous nobody on the end of the phone, and some of these polls now actually use automated calling scripts, so-called robocalls, you'll press a touch tone literally. So there's no human interaction at all. So that might be another factor, is that people feel more free to express themselves.
Nate, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nate Silver is founder of the blog 538.com. If you've studied psychology, you may have come across a phenomenon known as the bystander effect. It states that individuals are less likely to help in an emergency when other people are present. You may have heard of it referred to as the Genovese syndrome, named for Kitty Genovese, a young woman murdered in Kew Gardens, Queens, New York, 45 years ago. Her death wasn't just tragic, it was an indictment of humanity, as issued in the lead of the New York Times story. Quote, "For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in 3 separate attacks in Kew Gardens." That story offered irrefutable evidence of the dehumanizing effects of urban life. But subsequent investigations suggest that the evidence was not so clear-cut. Joseph DeMay is a lawyer, historian, and resident of Kew Gardens. He's studied the legal briefs and the court transcripts. He's walked the scene of the crime, and he's convinced he knows what really happened.
Kitty Genovese was returning that night from a night out, and she parked her car in the parking lot of the Long Island Railroad Station. What she did not know was that she had been followed by a man in a white car, a man by the name of Winston Mosley, and his aim that night was to find a woman that he could kill. As soon as Winston Mosley saw her lock the door to her car, he pulled a hunting knife out of his pocket and he started running toward her. According to his testimony, he chased her about half a block down the street toward Lefferts Boulevard, caught up with her, jumped on her back and stabbed her 2 to 4 times in the back with a hunting knife. She started screaming bloody murder, and her screams started to wake people who were asleep in an apartment building across the street and in a 2-story Tudor-style building which was on the same side of the street, remembering, of course, that the attack took place at about 3:15 in the morning on what was supposedly the coldest night of the year, so people had their windows shut. Mosley said he was standing over Kitty, trying to figure out a place he could take her to work on her, when he heard someone call out from the building across the street, "Leave that woman alone." He then realized that his car was parked where it could be identified. So he ran off, got into his car, backed it around 82nd Road, about half a block up, parked and waited. In the meantime, Kitty walked, however unsteadily, around to the back of the building. She collapsed inside a small foyer in the back of that two-story Tudor building. And 10 minutes later, Mr. Mosley came back, found her there, and that's where she suffered the wounds that would eventually kill her. There was only one person who was in a position to witness that second attack, and that was a man who had an apartment, the entrance to which was at the top of the stairwell to that vestibule. He said that he didn't want to call the police because he didn't want to get involved. Apparently, his problem is that he was inebriated. He had been highly intoxicated. So he contacted a woman who lived in the building, and she eventually did call the police.
Wasn't she screaming during the second attack?
The wounds that she apparently suffered during the first attack, the 2 to 4 stabs in the back, caused her lungs to be punctured. And the testimony given at trial is that she died not from bleeding to death, but from asphyxiation. The air from her lungs leaked into her thoracic cavity, compressing the lungs, making it impossible for her to breathe. I am not a doctor, but as a layman, my question is, if someone suffers that type of lung damage, are they even physically capable of screaming for a solid half hour?
This article in the New York Times was written by a longtime copy editor named Martin Gansberg. Editor A. Rosenthal gave Gansberg the story. How did the misreporting happen?
According to Abe Rosenthal, he first learned of the story when he had lunch with the New York City Police Commissioner. He had just been appointed Metropolitan Editor. And he was questioning the commissioner about a story that had been published in recent days where apparently two men who did not know each other had confessed to the same murder. And of course, Rosenthal's question was, how could such a thing have happened? And it was at that point that the commissioner said, never mind that, I've got to tell you the story about what happened in Kew Gardens. And he related the story of apparently these witnesses who witnessed a murder and wouldn't report it. And suddenly, Mr. Rosenthal was off on that tangent. He decided that that was a story that he needed to run. If you look at the Times article, it looks like there were two hands there. The first paragraph takes an entirely different tact than the rest of the story in the accompanying picture. What I think happened is that Mr. Gansberg turned in probably what he thought was a very carefully written article, and Mr. Rosenthal, who still knew about the story from what the commissioner told him, rewrote that first paragraph and tacked it onto the story. And it was that paragraph that people remember.
Where do you think the number 38 came from?
No one knows. All I can tell you is that there's a man named Charles Scholar, and he was the assistant prosecutor. He helped prosecute Winston Mosley. And he said he doesn't know where the 38 witness number came from. He said that the district attorney's office found only maybe 5 or 6 people who saw anything that they could use. And of the people he identified, there are only really 2 that I know of who actually saw any part of the physical attack.
And the only person who could be said to have ignored the plight of this young woman was that man at the top of the stairs.
Well, let me tack on that word, ignored. The rap against the witnesses is not that they sat there and watched what was going on. It was that they heard a scream and did not act upon it. Now, why didn't they act upon it? The common belief is that they didn't want to get involved. And, of course, that quote comes from the one guy at the top of the stairs who said that. But if you look at the Rosenthal book, the people who were interviewed later on said they didn't know why. I think a number of them were uncertain about what was going on. Others truly thought that other people would call. Others thought that whatever the crisis was, the fact that the attacker had left and Kitty had left the scene under her own power meant there wasn't a problem anymore. And I have to tell you that I do not by any means accept that no one called the police. One of the people who contacted me is a retired New York City police officer who said that he was an 8-year-old boy whose bedroom was on the second floor of that apartment building on the night of the murder. And he said his father did call the police because he was there in the living room when he did. I've heard second or third hand about 2 other people who also said that they called the police.
Why do you think the wrong story was so iconic?
The Kitty Genovese murder happened 4 months after the assassination of President Kennedy. In the aftermath of John Kennedy's assassination, there was a school of thought that said, we all killed President Kennedy. Now, 4 months later, Kitty Genovese is killed, not by a man whose psyche and life experience is not in any way reflective of ordinary Americans. These were 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens. That was us. And I think it was a tremendous blow to the American psyche to think that such a thing could happen here, anywhere here. And I think that that's what gave the story legs.
After all the research you've done on this case, do you still believe in the bystander effect?
I don't think it's a question of my belief. We've seen over the past year a number of news stories in which a parallel has been drawn with the Kitty Genovese case. It was the incident back in January where a poor worker was trampled at the Greenacre Shopping Center by shoppers anxious to get to an electronics sale. There was the woman in Kings County Psychiatric Ward who collapsed on the floor. The staff simply left her there to die 4 hours later. So you can look in the newspapers and you can see almost on a daily basis incidents occur which are reflective of what's known as the bystander syndrome and diffusion of responsibility. And it's impossible to say that such a phenomenon of some sort does not exist.
But you can't tie that syndrome directly to the murder of Kitty Genovese.
Interesting point. Usually the bystander syndrome theory says that when you have a group of people, everyone is looking to someone else to take action. But in this particular case, you didn't have a group of people. You had individuals. I think there were probably a number of people who knew that there was something more than just a lover's quarrel at stake, and they may not have taken any action. You can justly criticize them for that. My point is that we didn't have what the Herald Tribune, I think, described at the time as being a scene reminiscent of the Roman Colosseum, with the Romans watching the Christians being slaughtered while they cheered them on. It's that scenario that didn't happen, not that the witnesses were not blameless.
Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Joseph DeMay is a lawyer, historian, and resident of Kew Gardens.
Coming up, the image of hippies spitting on Vietnam vets is familiar and infuriating. But is it true? More myth-busting after the break.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with another cultural trope to debunk. Do war protesters, dating back at least as far as Vietnam, spit on the troops? Is that something they really do? The question emerged in January 2007 when the anti-war group United for Peace and Justice held a rally in Washington. The coverage of that rally became a hot issue in the liberal blogosphere, mostly because of the placement of a source in some of those stories, Joshua Sparling, an Army veteran who lost part of his leg in Iraq. Deep in an article in the New York Times, he claimed that a belligerent protester spat at him, and he spat back. The critics noted that the story didn't report that Sparling was part of an organized counter-protest, nor did it mention that he seemed to be a frequent victim of soldier haters, at least according to his own testimony on Fox News, where he was a regular guest, and that he'd been seated at a President Bush State of the Union address in the seats just behind Lynn Cheney. In short, said the critics, this guy was not just a veteran gunslinger, but a partisan one.
The New York Times stood by its story. They told us at the time that its reporter witnessed the spitting incident with her own eyes. We took them at their word. After all, haven't we all heard of this kind of thing happening to vets from another unpopular war? 15 years ago, sociologist and Vietnam vet Jerry Lemke set out to trace the incidents of spitting stories in the media. He delved into press archives from the 60s and 70s, and what he found was very surprising. Not a single first-hand account of a vet getting spit on, and close to no published claims by anyone so ignobly victimized.
So it really wasn't until about 1980 that these stories began to circulate. They sort of began to pop up like mushrooms in the spring and began to appear in popular culture. Films like the first Rambo film make reference to Rambo says he was spat on when he came home.
It wasn't my war! You asked me, I didn't ask you! And I did what I had to do to win, but somebody wouldn't let us win! And I come back to the world, and I see all those maggots at the airport protesting me, spitting, calling me baby killer and all kinds of vile crap!
So that's what the spitting story sounded like in 1982. Let's take a listen to what it sounded like in 2007. Here's Josh Sparling on Sean Hannity's radio show describing his alleged spitting incident.
That was the worst afternoon of being American that I've ever had in my life, and they actually made me feel ashamed to be a soldier almost. They they kept calling me a baby killer and a murderer, and they said I was a disgrace, and I had blood covering my hands. They don't know how I sleep at night.
So here you give your leg for your country. Here you go off and you put your life at risk for your country for the right to these morons to say whatever they want at their little rally there. And the thanks you get for it is just like a lot of vets after Vietnam, you get spit at.
You know, that, and that's exactly almost how I felt. I thought back, and I'm sure it wasn't as bad as it was back then, but I just was like, wow, this is must have been what they felt like.
Apart from your particular suspicions about this incident, tell me how the story that played out last week resembled the stories that you've been following over the last 35 years.
Well, the veracity of the stories themselves is only part of what I'm interested in. Stories like this may be true or they may not be true. Of course, I can't prove that they're not true, but it's how they play into a kind of betrayal narrative for why we lost the war in Vietnam, and in this case, why it is that we would lose the war in Iraq also. The allegation here being that it's protesters at home that undermine the morale of the troops. And some Bush administration spokespeople saying that this is lending aid and comfort to the enemy. And both of these are kind of themes in the spitting stories that followed out of the Vietnam War.
Why are we so prepared to believe that these were commonplace incidents in the Vietnam era?
Well, it's a face-saving device. It helps construct an alibi, the alibi being that we beat ourselves, that we were defeated on the home front, and that we, this most powerful nation on earth, was not defeated by this small upstart nation of Asian others. It's a dangerous myth because coming out of Vietnam, it kept alive the idea that we could win wars like Vietnam if we just stuck together as a country, if we just stayed solid behind the war effort.
I want to ask you about self-fulfilling prophecy, or maybe self-fulfilling mythology, but is it possible that as a society we have so internalized the idea of returning soldiers from unpopular wars being spat upon that it actually becomes something that protesters might do thinking that's, you know, the thing to do? Could that be going on right about now?
No, I think it's more the opposite. I think the internalization of the myth, I think that's a good insight. But I think it's more likely that people returning from Iraq expect to be spat on, and that what they expect is what they think happened to Vietnam veterans. So they come home looking for this to happen and looking for a chance to tell the story of how they were spat on when they came home from their war.
Okay. Jerry, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jerry Lemke is a sociology professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and Legitimacy of Vietnam.
Journalism has been called the first draft of history. But what if that draft is never corrected, or if the mistakes persist despite many subsequent drafts? President Bush harkened back to the peril we faced during the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962 and how we were saved by the uncompromising resolve of an earlier leader in order to justify our need to take preemptive action in Iraq. He was drawing on the first draft of history, the one that said John F. Kennedy went eyeball to eyeball with Nikita Khrushchev over Russian missiles in Cuba, and that Khrushchev blinked and withdrew.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
Major players in the Cuban Missile Crisis, including then presidential speechwriter Ted Sorensen and former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, have tried in recent years to correct the record of those events, but the national myth seems pretty much unshakable. Fred Kaplan, Slate columnist and, incidentally, Brooke's husband, has examined all the declassified material related to that crisis as it's emerged over the years. We asked him to take us through the various drafts of the Cuba showdown.
The basic scenario came from an article published shortly after the crisis by Stuart Alsop, who was a very establishment columnist of the day, who got the information from aides to Kennedy in the White House who were authorized by Kennedy to give him this account. Eyeball to eyeball with the Russians, crazy generals on one hand wanting us to bomb the missiles right away, lunatic doves like Stevenson on the other wanting to negotiate their way out of it from the beginning, and, you know, smart guys like Kennedy and McNamara and Bundy navigating a cool and calm course through the thickets and ending us up safe to shore.
That's a heroic and reassuring recounting of the events. And it's certainly not the first nor the last time that a journalist has run with leaked information. But do you think Alsop had any way to know that the story he was writing did not, in fact, reflect the events as we now know them?
No, I don't think he had any way of knowing that. This is what people told him, and he certainly wasn't privy to any of the inside stuff going on. And in fact, this was confirmed in the second draft of history, the memoirs, written by two of what could be called the palace historians, Arthur Schlesinger and Ted Sorensen, Sorensen being Kennedy's speechwriter at the time, who was present at all of the, what they called the EXCOM meetings, the meetings of the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, which got together for the 13 days and deliberated what to do. And this basically told the same story, though with more detail.
These memoirs by the palace guard, when did they appear?
That was in the mid-60s. This was Sorensen's book called Kennedy and Schlesinger's 1,000 Days.
Okay, so what's the third rough draft? When did that happen? What form did it take?
The third draft was mainly by revisionists, by people like Gary Wills, who in 1971 wrote a book called Kennedy Agonistes. Now, it had been revealed early on that Khrushchev had made an offer toward the end of the crisis, basically saying, look, I'll take my missiles out of Cuba if you take your missiles out of Turkey. At the time, the United States had 15 nuclear missiles in Turkey, which were similar in range and power to the missiles that the Soviets put in Cuba. Ted Sorensen, in his book, dismissed that Khrushchev offer as total propaganda and that Khrushchev dropped in the end. Well, Gary Wills and the revisionists picked up on this, and they said, look, this guy Kennedy was a maniac. He was soaking in machismo. He led the United States and the world on the brink of World War III because he wouldn't take this sensible offer to do the missile trade.
Machismo was certainly part of the popular image of JFK back then. Here's a clip from a 1970s TV docudrama, Missiles of October, starring a very young William Devane.
Now we must convey an uncompromising message. This government is prepared to negotiate. But not until those missiles are removed from Cuba. We will not be deterred. We will not be shaken. We'll bomb if we must. We'll invade if we must.
Yeah, that clip is just hilarious. Diametrically opposed to the way John Kennedy was acting at any of those sessions. In fact, this does lead us to the fourth draft of history. Tapes that Kennedy had secretly been making. Long before Nixon and before Johnson, Kennedy was taping a lot of things that happened in the Oval Office and in the cabinet room where the EXCOM meetings took place. And we hear very clearly in those meetings that Kennedy took Khrushchev's offer of the missile trade very, very seriously. In fact, on the third day of the crisis, Kennedy is already musing that, well, you know, Khrushchev, he's made a miscalculation. He's obviously done this for bargaining leverage. And we're going to have to help him find a way to save face. Maybe if we trade those missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba, that might be the answer. Nobody even takes him up on it. So on the last day of the crisis, when Khrushchev does bring it up, he's very eager to take it. And in fact, he is the only one in the room who's willing to take it. You know, there's been this model from the first draft of history on that the room was divided into hawks and doves and centrists. But in fact, on the last couple of days of the crisis, the room was divided between John Kennedy and everybody else. Everybody else in that room wanted to bomb the missiles in Cuba, and only John Kennedy wanted to take the trade.
Now, unaccustomed as we are to having presidential tapes reveal the president in a positive light.
Yeah.
Nixon certainly was ensnared by his own voice on tape. It must have had an astonishing effect. When were the tapes released, and how long did it take before this real version of history informed our public understanding of the crisis?
Word of the tapes first came out in 1982, 20 years after the crisis, when several of Kennedy's advisors, McGeorge Bundy, Robert McNamara, a few others, wrote a little article in Time magazine in which they admitted that the myth of the Cuban Missile Crisis was false. When I interviewed Ted Sorensen about this 5 years ago, he admitted that basically Kennedy, after that last XCOM meeting, he took seven people into his office and he told them that, look, I'm sending my brother over to the Soviet embassy and I'm going to accept this deal, but you can't tell anybody. And that after Kennedy was assassinated, they all got together and pledged that nobody would ever reveal this. The first tape was revealed in 1987, and it was of the last day of the crisis where Khrushchev comes out with a deal and Kennedy says, hey, this is a pretty good deal. And everybody in the room is shouting him down, saying this will wreck NATO. We can't do this. It'll ruin our credibility. Kennedy lets them talk on. And at one point he says, look, to any man at the United Nations or any other rational man, it will look like a very fair trade. I'm reading from the transcript here. And later he also says, and this I think is the telling point, he says, well, I'm just thinking about what we're going to have to do in a day or so, which is 500 sorties. The airstrike plan called for 500 air sorties against the Cuban missile sites every day for 7 days.
I'm just thinking about what we're going to have to do in a day or so, which is 500 sorties in 7 days and possibly an invasion, all because we wouldn't take missiles out of Turkey. We all know.
Kennedy goes on, all because we wouldn't take missiles out of Turkey. We all know how quickly everybody's courage goes when the blood starts to flow, and that's what is going to happen to NATO. When they start these things and they grab Berlin, everybody's going to say, well, that was a pretty good proposition.
Memoirists. Once these revelations came out in McGeorge Bundy's own memoir, how did journalism react? Having been unwitting accomplices in a historical lie, did newspapers jump on this story to kind of set the record straight, and do you think it had any effect?
I have to say, both among journalists and historians, this chapter of the Cuban Missile Crisis has not yet been fully incorporated into the dominant narrative, as academics might call it today. And to the degree that people do know there was a trade, it is as yet not generally well accepted how alone Kennedy was.
I'm curious about how much the truth of the Cuban Missile Crisis has found its way into the public consciousness. If it has, I suppose you can credit the film 13 Days from 2 years ago. Hollywood took another look at the history books and did substantially incorporate our current understanding in that film. Let's hear a little bit of that.
We've got time for one more round of diplomacy, and that's it. First airstrikes start in 28 hours.
But we have to make them agree to it.
Right. So how do we do that?
Well, we give them something. We tell them we're going to remove the missiles from Turkey.
Yeah, right.
Hang on. But we do that 6 months from now, so it appears there's no linkage.
We also tell them if they go public about it, we'll deny it.
Right. We deny it. The deal's off.
And we do it under the table so we can disavow any knowledge of it.
It's transparent, Kenny. The press will be all over it.
6 months from now, we're not going to care, are we?
In your review of that film, 13 Days, you made another point about learning from history. It was about the supposition that a president surrounded by a circle of trusted advisors can be depended on to make the right decision. And you made a connection to the George W. Bush White House. Make it again.
The point was, I think George W. Bush had just been elected president. And a lot of people were wondering if he would be smart enough to deal with crises. And the common explanation at the time was, well, don't worry, he has a lot of really smart people around him. And the point that you can take from the fourth draft of the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis is that the people around John Kennedy were really smart. I mean, these were the people that David Halberstam later called, in a note of irony, the best and the brightest. And yet John Kennedy realized that they really weren't very smart after all. And the lesson of that is that you can have good advisors, but the crucial thing is that you need a president. It's the president who makes the decisions.
Well, Fred Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan is a columnist for Slate. His new book, 1959, The Year Everything Changed, is fresh off the presses. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Bob, I have one more debunking.
Oh, yeah?
It turns out frogs, when you turn up the heat, they don't boil to death. They actually do jump out of the pot.
They don't get acclimatized 1 degree at a time?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Oops.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.